Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Oh, and welcome to you, my wonderful, wonderful, wonderful audience. Today is going to be a extraordinary treat. It's a couple you just will hardly ever see anywhere. If you see them on the screen right now, you can see they're in their bunker with a surrounded by black concrete.
Yes.
I love these two people. Ginger and I have given them the Honored Researcher Award. Their names are Aaron and Melissa Dykes, D-Y-K-E-S. They are among the most important, I feel, think of them as young people. I think they've got grown children, but they're young people by my standards. They are doing some of the very most important work in the world today. They really are looking at the dark side. They are the creators of the amazing film, The Minds of Men, which for the first time documented in a very thorough fashion the relationship between mind control doctors who are out in the open, the psychosurgeons I went after in my psychosurgery campaign among them, but some of the top names in psychology back in the 70s, the 60s, the 80s, some of them, well, kind of still around and certainly respected, who were getting money from the CIA, getting money from the Justice Department, doing experiments on psychosurgery, doing experiments on various kinds of remote mind control with electrodes, stuff that I actually was doing the initial documentation of in my anti-psychosurgery campaign. And you can find out more of this on Breggin.com. Just look up look up mind control. You'll get there. And if you just plug in Aaron and Melissa Dykes, just like that, in the search, you'll get their award. You'll find your way to their website, which is Truth Stream Media. Did I get that right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Truth Stream Media. They have been kind enough to put up material on Monarch, these awful experiments that have now been approved by the FDA for the treatment of children with ADHD, which means any child at all they can give this to. There's no hold bars once the FDA approves it. And they have been behind me and supporting me and going after Monarch. They have put up a wonderful video that I call the most important video that we, meaning me and Ginger, had ever seen, which is the actual name is Put a Chip in Your Brain. It's about Elon Musk, the cars that are supposed to drive by themselves. Sometimes they explode, sometimes they bang into things. And Elon Musk wants to now control the brain, and you won't believe it till you go and you go to True Stream Media and you look up Putting a Chip in Your Brain, and you see this man, Elon Musk, standing on a stage looking very strange indeed, really looking like the mad scientist gone over the edge, talking and giggling at times to a massive audience, bringing out for the first time his efforts at mind control. What did he call it exactly? The name's escaping me.
It's a Neuralink device. Neuralink device. And they're going to use a DARPA-created sewing machine to sew electrodes into people's brains and then hook a chip up to their phone. That's the plan.
That is Melissa Dykes. Melissa,
hi. Hi, everyone.
Tell folks what, and we'll come back more to your work, but let's just start talking.
Okay.
Tell folks, you know, what is DARPA? Let them know.
That's the Defense Advanced Research Agency. And, you know, they've got all the shadow funding and Pentagon funding, and they work with bodies like NQTEL, which is another government-sponsored body that basically they provide money for startups, for technology primarily, and everything from TV to military weapons to computer chips that they want to put inside human beings' brains. You know, they fund and incubate and test in secret until it's ready to deploy in some fashion. And we really have the benefit of hindsight at this point, I think, not only in terms of MKUltra and the CIA stuff and the psychosurgery stuff that you were involved in, Dr. Bregan.
Peter. Actually, these folks are my friends.
We have become friends for sure.
Yeah, I love you, Peter.
I love you.
Nice, you're like family to us. And
yes.
It was amazing to get to speak with you for the film because so many of the people who were involved probably wouldn't have talked to us anyway, but they're not here anymore regardless. And you were kind enough to talk to us, and you were there, and you saw what happened with part of it. You know, you blew the whistle, and it's atrocious, the things that happen. But I think see in hindsight...
You came out. I want to interrupt now. By the way, I want to tell the audience, I don't know what I'm going to look like exactly. We're using new technology. When I'm talking right to you, I'm looking at the camera. And then sometimes I'm looking down because I want to see what you see, which is I want to see these shining faces of Aaron and Melissa Dykes. So I'm not sure how that technology is going to work out, but my wife has given me a thumbs up behind the camera. She's my real partner in this.
Well, we've got a similar thing
technology.
Here. Sometimes we look at the eye and sometimes we look at your face.
This is a weird way they've set everything up.
Well, we're going to see. But I want you guys. See, they had done this film on Elon Musk and how he is bringing together money. He wants to get the other billionaires together. You know, he wants to be on the cutting edge of implanting electrodes, which he said are just tiny things like threads into the brain. He won't be able to pull these threads out easily, guys. Believe me.
These were conspiracies just a few years ago, and now they're actually really talking about doing it. And probably they've already done it to some people. I don't know. But
they've got to have been doing it to people.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we didn't know at the time that the federal agency which has got its own website, but is certainly a part of the deepest, darkest state, the deepest, darkest swamp. Where did you find out? I know where, but where did you find out this amazing information that they actually created the product working with UCLA and funded the product that Elon Musk was going to use for sewing electrodes into people's brains? What was this deep, dark place you found it?
You mean from the minds of men?
No, he's talking about DARPA.
They
didn't, when they promoted Neuralink in the news and they said, oh, there's a big announcement now. Elon Musk is going to come out and tell everyone about this. No mainstream media outlets talked about the DARPA ties to this situation. Elon Musk didn't mention it. None of the people on his team at Neuralink mentioned it. DARPA themselves happened to have an Instagram account, which I happen to follow because of the research that we do. And when Elon Musk made this announcement, then the following day, they posted a picture on their Instagram account proudly saying, we had a part in this too, DARPA. We were part of making this robot. I think the most disconcerting thing about this, Peter, is that all the stuff we research in the minds of men, all of these people like Dr. Robert Heath and Dr. Jose Delgado, they were putting things in people's brains and pushing buttons and seeing what it did with these electrodes. And there's a clip in the film, The Minds of Men, where Dr. Robert Heath actually says, I don't see how this could be abused or misused. You know, it's such a invasive surgery process to have this team of neurosurgeons. They have to cut open your brain. They have to do all this. And one of the most disconcerting things that I think is that was always the deterrent, right, as to how this would never be used in mass against everyone. And when Elon Musk gave his presentation about this, DARPA, it's basically a robot sewing machine that will sew all of these electrodes into the brain, way more than has ever been medically approved officially. I think he said like 1,000 or something. It was a lot.
They can deal with the tininess. And,
it's these little carbon threads. It literally looks like a sewing machine into the brain tissue. And he's talking about how this is going to be an outpatient procedure. It's going to be less invasive, basically, than getting an infected toenail removed now. You're going to have a tiny little, I think, 2 millimeter incision that'll be widened to 8 millimeters. I mean, this is incredibly small. It's not going to require any kind of inpatient thing, whatever. They even made it sound like it might not even require that much anesthetic. So it's going to be less invasive to go get all of these electrodes sewn into your brain with this robot than it would be to get a tattoo or your ears pierced, basically. And that to me is just horrifying because it's not even, I mean, there's not going to be, it's not going to be like a second thought. It's just going to be a trendy thing that people could do. They make it sound like they'll just have a kiosk at a mall or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's not going to quite be to that level, but I mean, it's insane.
Let me give you a little background on this technology, folks. See, the brain does not feel pain. There aren't pain fibers right in the brain. When you have a headache, it's not actually within the flesh of your brain that this pain is coming from. So once you bore a hole in the head, like in the old-fashioned lobotomies, or once you've cut the skull and opened a flap in the old-fashioned lobotomies, which just required local anesthesia, you can go in and swish a spoon around, which is what they did. They would swish big spoons around in the front of the brain to have a wonderful mental health, which was effect on you, which was known to be 80% effective until Peter Breggin came along and pointed out, actually, it was 100% effective. It made everybody into a less feeling, subdued, more docile, wrecked human being. But this goes way back, and these kind of claims go way back to the initial psychosurgery when Walter Freeman used ice picks. He slid them around the corners of the eye because you can get around the eye and the skull is very thin. He tapped them on the back, these ordinary ice picks, he didn't even cleanse them, into the brain, swish them around in the front of the lobes. The FDA never intervened. No one ever sued him. He didn't get attacked till I came along. Nobody dared even go into court against him until I came along, and we had a great suit against him, and he died. And I couldn't go on and sue his estate because in where we were suing him, we couldn't do that. So, I mean, this is all frontier stuff. This is stuff that nobody since me has dared touch. And Aaron and Melissa Dykes, I will look at them right now because I really would love to just be looking at you throughout this. These folks matter. And they mentioned a guy named Heath. Heath. He just fits right into this program. Heath was inserting electrodes into the brains of people. He had federal funding, which Aaron and Melissa found out about. I don't think I knew that at the time I was going after them and trying to shut them down. I think I did shut them down. But they were putting electrodes into the heads of people who were either gay or who were pedophiles. And then they were trying to fix them by burning holes into their brains while they're watching pictures and stimulating their brains and doing all these terrible things. This is the kind of stuff our government has funded, and we know it. I wrote about it way back then. And if you go to my website and look up psychosurgery for political purposes, you'll find probably the best review article I've ever done. I couldn't get a book published on this, by the way. There were books published attacking me for attacking it, but I couldn't get a book published. But I got a major law review on psychosurgery for political purposes, which you can get a lot of the background. But better yet, go and watch Aaron and Melissa Dykes, The Minds of Men. They're very sweet. They said starring Peter Breggin. The whole film is good. I come up in maybe the last quarter, last half talking about this stuff, but it's a really important film. I think that I'm really glad how this is going in a more impromptu fashion because there's, you guys, there's so much for you to be talking about. TruthStream Media is where you get to them. Now, the big wigs in the big tech companies are trying to crush the minds of men. it quickly went to 1 million viewers, then more slowly it reached 2 million, then it started spreading to nearly 3 million. Those are only the ones we can count. Mm-hmm. This is huge. These are not nobodies. You know, they belong in. I think they're embarrassed by teasing them. They belong in this dark shroud with a bright light on their faces, because they are serious, endangered people. And
I mean, the movie went to 1 million views in 3 weeks. And then as soon as that happened, it was manually shut down by the people over at YouTube. Usually, if they decide something isn't advertiser friendly, you have to go in, a robot will somehow do that, and then you have to go in and ask for a manual review. That never happened. All of a sudden, just one day, we come in after it had gone up really fast in views, and it was preemptively manually declared to be not advertiser friendly with no explanation, because that's how the new rules work on all these social media sites. They don't have to tell you, they can just censor whatever. And so they took it out of circulation and made it much harder to find. Even though it's headed towards 3 million views, it's not the first search result that comes up if you type in the Minds of Men. Other stuff with less views will be up there first. You have to scroll down to find it.
You literally, folks, might think that this this 3 million viewed movie was only seen by 300 people, because one of the websites that it's on, it was only seen by 300 people. I saw that too. You can get to it directly through my website still, Bregan.com, and just put in their names or put in the Minds of Men. You'll be able to get to it.
Amazon took it down also.
Yeah, so. Amazon really punished it. And that's the age we live in, where social media can pretend to be fair and open for everyone and promoting views. But when there's something they don't approve of, they can censor it very quietly. And they don't have to come out, you know. They don't have to do something drastic. It's very subtle.
It had 4.3 stars out of 5 with 76 reviews on Amazon. It's won. I mean, we've won Best Director. We've won Best. We've won a lot of things. We headlined that movie headlined at an Italian film festival, and they liked it so much they played the entire film at the festival, which is amazing because it's so long. And they used the artwork from the film for their poster to promote their film festival in Italy. So this has won awards all over the world now, but Amazon took it down, saying that it did not meet customer standards or something, and there was no appeal process and no review. And, I mean,
it's a phony process.
Amazon, they've got, you know, contracts with the CIA, so I'm not exactly surprised at that. But at the same time, I mean, we researched this movie for over 3 years. We used the credits, because it's just a team of the two of us. We used the credits of the film to cite our top, I think, 140 sources,
something like that.
If it's an APA style paper, because we wanted people to be able to not just watch the film and get the information from this film, but to go for themselves and be able to look those sources up and see for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, and every film has its viewpoint, but ours is very much grounded in the documentation, so anyone who watches it can come to their own conclusions, and they can go further and research it if they want. And the thing is, this is a very important film, not just because it was our labor of passion and we put all our work into it, it's because this is stuff the American people in the world should have been told from the beginning,
and never were.
For obvious reasons, we weren't. And even when a lot of this came out about what the CIA and other agencies were involved in with the huge nebulous MKUltra project, you know, it really was a cover story that came out in the 70s. And, you know, there were hearings, there were some exposés, there was Peter Bregan there. But the fact is that what came out publicly in the papers and on TV was a joke. They spun it as some kind of fly-by-night boys' club, you know, messing around with drugs and prostitutes and, you know, loose projects everywhere. No, there was completely a method to their madness. It was inhumane. It was bad science, mainly because they treated human subjects as just throwaways, you know. But they were aiming for something very much organized, and that never became clear. It's a little bit clearer in hindsight, which, you know, I think it was good, because we made the film, you know, it came out in 2018, and a lot of those things have been declassified. We were able to follow the names. We know the work publicly that a lot of these doctors have done, and so we could connect the pieces a little more. And today we have the internet. We understand the direction that social media is going, and we can actually see why would they want to stimulate the brain? Why would they want to ride the dopamine device inside the brain? Why do they want to addict people to an electronic signal? You know, there's a lot of answers to that question, but I think the human nervous system, you know, connected to the brain, they see it as connected to the internet, the electronic internet, the social media, the networks that now are all around the planet. You know, they really want us part of that system.
And part of a cybernetic system. I mean, that's what this was about.
They want our God-given natural human instincts to be subdued under that system.
Talk about the film that you've done on this, which is the Why You Can't Stop Clicking. Isn't that the one that kind of covers a lot of what you're just talking about?
Yeah, that definitely plays into it. That was kind of one of our weekly videos, but it was astonishing. You had a Silicon Valley CEO. He wasn't one of the big names, but he runs a major company. And he was in the papers talking about how he does dopamine fasting now. Dopamine fasting. And the article kind of ridiculed him, like, all right, you know, take a break sometimes. Maybe do meditation, go into nature, get off of the computer. Sure, we can all understand why that's valuable. But no, they use the term dopamine fasting because other executives, people who founded Facebook, who work inside that system and are very high up in it, have admitted they designed the system to occupy your time and to feed dopamine hits. When you use social media, you're getting dopamine hits. You become addicted to those clicks, and they have it all worked out so that basically you can't stop clicking after a while. And I think it's very revealing to have rich and powerful people acknowledging that their own technology is so harmful that they have to step away from it. They have to withdraw from it.
The way
they
you withdraw from a drug.
Point, not to interact with it, but they want everyone else in the world to interact with it. And, you know, these social media sites, they seem completely harmless. They seem benign. You know, you have some friends, you have some contacts.
You share some info.
But there's a science behind it, and it's a very manipulative application of that science. And, you know, and this does connect with Minds of Men. I don't know if we want to get into that area, but
any way you want. I just want to have a kind of a open forum with you today, because I think that the things you're thinking about, no one is really as open about it as you are that I know of. No one has as much information as you do. No one's thinking about it, researching it the way you are. So I really am just happy to have you just talking about more of what you're doing. And by the way, I'm very pleased to be supporting you and having you on the air and giving you the award. And I'm so grateful.
Thank you very much for recognizing us and having us.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I mean, you should have international as well.
It's a little embarrassing.
Well, you know, oh my God, you should be, you know. Well, if this world's going to survive, you're going to be heroes in the long run. Because that's how important what you're doing is. Let me take a breath and just suggest to you, and now I'm looking at you again because I really want to see your faces for a minute, folks. Now I'll look back at the audience. One of the things I was really grateful to them for was I've always asked filmmakers if they would mind sharing the interview with me so that later on I could use pieces of it, you know, after it wouldn't compete with them anymore. And no one's ever really done that. And then Aaron and Melissa Dykes, they sent me an edited version of my complete interview to put up simultaneously, practically, with their film. I couldn't believe it. Then later on, they themselves put up the uncut, unedited version of it, just wanting people to know what I think, what I'm doing, what I'm talking about. And it takes courage to do that, too, or more folks would obviously be doing it, because there's certainly no lack of interest in what I'm doing and no lack of interest in what Aaron and Melissa are doing. Where do you see the future going? my friends? Where do you see yourself going?
Well, before we answer that question, can I just tell your entire audience that's listening, without Peter Bregan, I think that things would have gotten much more Orwellian much faster in this society, because you were the only person that was coming out and saying, hey, this is really, really wrong, what is happening.
Yeah, we think you're a hero.
We think you're a hero. We think that without you, the history that we would have been talking about this movie would have been way, way worse. And it was already quite bad. So, I mean, I think you existing stopped a lot of things from proceeding as fast as they maybe would have. And I think everyone on this planet owes you a debt of gratitude for that.
Thank you. I want to say two things about that. One is, one of the most proud things I read in a book that was very critical of me was that the head of neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins had been stopped from doing psychosurgery by my anti-psychosurgery campaign. And he said, we neurosurgeons are going to have to get brave and tell the Peter Bregans of the world to go to hell before.
Nice.
And then he went on to say, and we'll have to do pristine science. They used to add that before me. But I want to mention Ginger Bregan, Virginia Ginger Bregan, because while the psychosurgery campaign stopped something horrific, I think that the campaign that she really pushed me into doing, which was the Stopping the Violence Initiative in the 1990s, and that's our book, which is called The War Against Children of Color. It originally came out as The War of Children in hardback, and they said they wouldn't call it The War of Children, The War Against Children of Color, because nobody would be interested in it. So when we got the rights back later, we put it out as a paperback, The War Against Children of Color. But it is also against all children. And in that, you'll find the best chapter of my psychosurgery campaign. But Ginger, in the 1990s, she discovered that the federal government was talking about a violence initiative that the most important psychiatrist in the federal government wanted to do research on, quote, inner city children. That's a code word for black or African Americans. And that he furthermore was saying this to the annual meeting of leaders in mental health, and he wanted to do genetic studies of black children to find out why they were so violent. Well, anybody who wants to do genetic studies on black children to find out why they're so violent is the equivalent of a Nazi wanting to do studies on Jews to see why they do what they do or something. I mean, it's pure eugenics.
Awful.
And Ginger said, we got to stop this. And I was away. I was flying across the North Pole to go to Great Britain from Utah giving talks. And she herself called the head of the Black Caucus at the time and spoke to his office. And by the time I got home, she had a transcript of the remarks, and it was much worse. What people were concerned about was that this man, I'm not even going to, well, it was Fred Goodwin. This man said young black males were just like rhesus monkeys who just want to have sex and be violent.
Wow.
And it was just awful. And no,
that's insane.
The only way it got into the news and she heard about it was that an African-American secretary who was in this huge audience of mental health leaders from around the country, including black leaders, there had to be some sprinkled in there, no one reported this except she did. And that's how Ginger got. Ginger got the transcript. We read the transcript, and she got it through the Black Caucus, through John Conyers, who was the head of the Black Caucus that year. And it actually outlined a whole eugenical program. It was much worse. We didn't know there were federal agencies throughout the government priming to get funding under Goodwin, who was the head of a branch that doesn't exist anymore, that was the overseer of all mental health, including the National Institute of Mental Health. And it was just huge, and nobody was blowing a whistle on it. Well, we blew a whistle, and Ginger had to work to get the media to cover it. Finally, it got covered on Black Television, which was at the time still doing news and stuff. I don't think it does so much anymore. But it was Johnson's Black Television Network. I forget the exact name of it. This is all impromptu today, folks. Right. I had no idea I'd be talking about this. So Ginger played a huge role in stopping. And then I got involved, of course, and together we just worked. And then we wrote the book, The War Against Children of Color. So this stuff is real. And Ginger played a huge role in helping me and goading me, because I was really busy at the time. Into taking on this huge campaign. She put 4 or 5 years in it. We got the program canceled.
Good.
And then we got a conference they were going to hold canceled and then reformatted. They were going to hold a conference on the genetics of violence. Well, there is none. Just holding for human beings.
Other than, you know, the whole paradigm's disgusting.
I mean, they've been trying to get something in on this eugenics idea of quote-unquote defective people or whatever. They've been trying to say this stuff since at least the 1800s, at least, and get some kind of program in. And the violence idea, that's a recycling of the program they were going to do in the early 70s under Jolly and West at the Neuropsychiatric Institute out in California, where they said they were going to go in with preemptive violence programs at what they said in their own proposal was going to be Black and Chicano schools. That's how they put it at the time. But he wanted to get an abandoned, a derelict military base out in the middle of absolute nowhere in the mountains out there to take people to. And we ended up finding this thing, and we show a shot of it at the end of our film. I mean, no one would hear you scream if they took you to a place like this where he was going to try and do these eugenics experimentation on these children's brains. I mean, you would not, there'd be no escaping it. You would be out in the middle of absolute nowhere behind barbed wire fences. It was horrifying. It was a very sobering moment to drive out there and see that this is actually what they were going to do. And it's amazing just, if you start researching the history of not just the American...
Was any of that in The Minds of Men?
Yes, that was at the
that
end.
Was in there.
We talk about the Violence Project. It's in the last part of it. We had to break the film up into
four
parts.
We could do
parts.
A whole film on the Violence Initiative. And
just that, yeah. Absolutely.
I say we. I say we. I mean you. And I'd love to participate.
Doing a film on eugenics is something we have definitely been researching and discussing for years and years and years, because
it's very, very important. Do you have any evidence that they're still talking about specifically eugenics? I'm not up on
that. Yes,
they absolutely are.
It's still in it, but what's astonishing to me, again, is going back. You read Brave New World, Aldous Huxley, and if you read the writings of Julian Huxley, they were a eugenics family, and they were talking about controlling psychology, and they were talking specifically about controlling physiology. As we know, that's a key code word in psychosurgery and in cybernetics, because this is the nervous system. This is the Pavlov system.
Yeah.
And if you figure out how the saliva and the bell works, you begin to have a mechanism for control. So eugenics, mind control, and the history of computers are pretty closely intertwined. I mean, sure, there's other parts of the agenda that don't always meet up, but it's pretty much a larger
was stunning.
Agenda.
That was stunning to me, Aaron, when in your film, and when you told me about it, right from the beginning with these guys that I remember reading in college. Oh my gosh, these wonderful cybernetic guys. They were involved with the federal government on mind control
Absolutely.
Stuff.
Oh, they were in the shadows, the gutters with that stuff.
In the gutters.
And not to say that some of them didn't do respectable work as well, but as a group, you know, it's a lot of nefarious individuals. And quite frankly, my conclusion after looking deeply into the names from psychosurgery and cybernetics and the other related fields is that they promoted people who agreed to work with the shadowy sides of the government. Those are the heroes, those are the names we know, and not to say they weren't intelligent or accomplished, but they were in on it, you know. By and large, as a rule of thumb, that's what I found. But, you know, with eugenics and cybernetics, eugenics, you know, I think a lot of people know, in the camps, they had the numbers tattooed on the arms. That wasn't just coincidence, it was being matched up with the Hollerith machine, which was the punch card computer of the day, and they were putting in people's identification numbers and matching it up with demographic columns. You know, you're in this category. You have this color eyes. You have this kind of height. You know, you have these characteristics and traits.
Yeah, I didn't know this. I just thought those numbers were like bean counting or something.
It was a Hollerith machine. It was IBM, wasn't it?
Yeah,
IBM.
Thomas Watson met with Hitler, for instance. But you know, this was all American and British people too. I mean, it was the same complex of individuals, despite being on opposite sides of World War II. And you know, while that was developing and going on, cybernetics research was happening behind the war. And this was the feedback mechanism. Today, we know it just as the input-output of the computer. But really, the actual creation of the computer was so that they could try to imitate the brain. They wanted an artificial brain. They wanted a system that could compute in a way that mimicked the flow of neurons in the brain. You know, they knew that it wouldn't be like the actual human brain at first, but the closer they could get to it, the more they could sort of mirror real life and replace it with ersatz. They could imitate it. And, you know, as this goes on, because it was very rudimentary in the 40s, and it got a little more sophisticated in the 50s, and as you had brain doctors, as you had neuroscientists, and various types of psychologists and psychiatrists and physiologists, all working on the nervous system and the brain, they got a little bit more into it. You know, James Olds found the reward system. You know, you could punish the brain, you could reward the brain. And the reward, though, is not a true reward. It's becoming hooked on a dopamine feedback system. That's what they're using in social media today. Mm-hmm. You know, we know what was going on with psychosurgery. It was horrible abominations going on in the 60s and 70s. Leonard Kyle, who's featured in The Minds of Men, was a key victim there because they had 80 some odd electrons in his brain, electrodes, in his amygdala, which was supposed to be part of the reward system, supposed to control violence, and they were dialing up emotions. You know, this comes right out of Wilder Penfield's research, right out of Delgado's research. They, to a certain degree, believed or were trying to prove that they could dial up artificial emotions, and right here you're angry, right here you're sad. Right here, you're feeling numb and just kind of floating around, and you know, this whole range of things. And
folks, if you want to hear more about this too, go to Minds of Men. Leonard Kyle was a person whose mother called me and told me he'd been, quote, turned into a vegetable. He was destroyed by the surgeons who wrote a book about curing him with no adverse effects. They wrote a book about cure violence in the brain. Harvard professors, Boston City neurosurgeons. You cannot believe how evil these people are. And they're also, oddly enough, not very smart. When I was told when I went, I had a meeting with the assistant director, the second level person at the National Institute of Mental Health when I took these people on. His name was Lou, and Lou was a nice guy. I'd known him when I was at the National Institute of Mental Health. And Lou said, "Peter, you can't go up and debate these guys. They'll eat you alive. They're neurosurgeons.
They're from Harvard."
And they're from Harvard. Well, I was from Harvard too, you know. But and I was nervous. I didn't, you know, I wasn't sure what was going on. I was just getting into the scientific literature, studying it. And what I realized was these guys, not only, I mean, it was unfair for them to go up against me. They didn't have a chance. I was in situations.
Because they were never questioned.
They never
questioned. Until you showed up.
Five of them didn't have a chance when I would go up against them. Because first, they didn't know their own literature. They couldn't remember what they published. They forgot, because I wasn't around, they were writing things like psychosurgery blunts the emotions of human beings. People who were formerly Episcopalians would go toward a more simplified religion like Methodism, writing this stuff. They couldn't write their autobiographies afterward. They could beforehand, but after you'd ask them, write their autobiographies, and they'd say, "I don't understand." Well, they'd look a little strange and say, I can't do it. So I realized that you don't have to, you know the old phrase, you know, you don't have to be a brain surgeon to do this or that. You don't have to be a brain surgeon to be a brain surgeon. These guys don't know anything. They just go into an area of the brain where pain isn't felt, and they swish around, they play around, they make up theories. They were arguing before I came along that you could pluck out obsessions and convulsions. Compulsions. You could pluck out aggression in the brain. And I was arguing that the brain is a highly integrated organ.
Yes.
It's 1970s. I'm a psychiatrist, not a neurologist or neurosurgeon. I'm arguing, I'm demonstrating, as any sensible person already knew, brain's a highly integrated organ. You go in there, you burn holes in it, in higher areas, you're going to have reverberating effects. You're not going to remove a psychiatric symptom. You're going to remove something about the whole human being. And I got ridiculed by neurosurgeons as being an integrationist of the brain.
Which has been validated in the decades since. They absolutely know that that is the case. I mean, you cannot put, it doesn't matter if Elon Musk comes out with the tiniest carbon fiber known to man, smaller than the width of a human hair, which is what he claims. Once you put something in brain tissue, no matter how small it is, that brain tissue never is the same again. You have made an irreparable change to the organ that processes all of the sense data that creates your perception and your reality. So you are messing with your actual reality. And what's really disconcerting to me is the way that all this is moving now towards this transhumanist, it's really trendy, we're all going to be made into this, you know, cyborgs and all this kind of talk, is really just the belief behind it that your experiences are just signals in your brain. So it doesn't matter. That this is the new way, that this hardcore scientific materials viewpoint of, you know, love isn't really love. It's just a signal. It's just an electric signal that can be dialed up in your brain.
Right.
You know, and it's not, there's more to us as human beings. It does not take into account your soul. It does not take into account the deeper meanings to these connections and communications and emotions. And it's a horrifying idea the way that they're looking at this. So if they tell people you just have electrical signals, it's no big deal. We'll just push a bunch of buttons and you can just dial it up and we'll all live in a Philip K. Dick novel or something.
I was going to mention Philip K. Dick because, you know, and there's the movie Blade Runner that people know very well. And there's the book it's based upon, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And basically you get into the question of what is human? Are you human? Do you even know if you're human? But the opening chapter of the book, Do Electroids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Androids Dream of Electric Sheep.
I'm sorry. The opening chapter, there's the main character, Deckard, who's having an argument with his wife because they live in a house with a device that they call a Penfield mood organ. So it shows you right away.
They named it after Wilder Penfield.
Yeah, Philip K. Dick is aware of the neuroscience, and this is a device that dials up an emotion. You pick a number, and you're supposed to feel that way for the day until you change to a different number. So if you want to feel great,
you just dial it up. You know?
And, you know, so the wife basically was trying to grieve for the things that were happening in society because the conditions were not that good. And she was dialing up basically depressive moods, and he was angry about it because why not have a good day?
You know, but
he's not living an authentic life.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's what we face for the future. I think on the one hand, very much there's an indomitable human spirit, and there's something, je ne sais quoi, about life. I don't think they can ever quite catch it. I think they're like cartoon villains in a G.I. Joe movie or something. I'll get you next time. You know, but at the same time, they're working very methodically in the shadows to substitute real life and to mediate our experience with real life and with other real people. And I think we do have the very real risk, even if things didn't progress any more than they're at right now, I think we run the risk of losing touch with what it means
to be
human.
With our humanity.
And I think there's a lot of people who are not having real experiences for the most part, even right now today. And I think it stands to get much worse. We've seen what can happen on the internet with authorization, you know, access denied. You know, if they put these devices in your brain and people accept them and use them, perhaps certain emotional responses won't be available to you. Perhaps you won't have access to certain areas of thought. I mean, they did a study a couple of years ago suggesting that a magnetic, transcranial magnetic effect on the thalamus could change your belief in God or your political alignment.
That was an Air Force study.
Now, there's a lot of reasons to, you know, change or progress your view of spirituality and God or of politics, but having someone externally stimulate you into an artificial thought about it is a pretty terrible condition to alter your belief in God or politics. I mean, the implications are bad.
We are living in a science fiction movie that's coming true and playing out right now, and humanity as a whole is going to have to start making some serious decisions about these things. And the problem is that no one is being told. No one is being told about this. They're just being sold this idea of how cool it's going to be to, you know, have a robot sew all these electrodes in your brain and hook it to your phone, and you can, you know, think your thoughts into Facebook. And I mean, they're just selling it to people like it's going to be this trendy, cool thing, and they're not talking about the very real ramifications of what that's going to do to you when you change the organ that mediates the sense data that projects your reality.
You know, as far as the Minds of Men film, for those who haven't seen it, I would urge you to see it. I think it really is important to see.
By the way, it's free.
It's free to watch. It's quite long, but it is in parts. So, you know, take your time, do it over a couple days, whatever suits you. But, you know, we interviewed you, Peter, and we heard your story on psychosurgery and what happened to Leonard Kyle. And then we separately looked into cybernetics and basically found that the groundwork for the internet we're using today, that was nothing 10 years ago. It was a dial-up with a weird clicky sound on AOL, you know, 20 years ago. They were working on that in the 40s and 50s. They had the vision then, and it was just a technical problem of getting to a sophistication level, you know. And by the way, that same computer stuff goes back to the build-up to World War II. There's a lot of history in it.
There's a lot of history.
The point I'm trying to make is, you know, we also found in Delgado's work, who did work with
all of these other
Vernon Mark. He was involved with the Leonard Kyle case. He had worked with a chimp named Patty, and Patty had these same kind of electrodes built in. You know, he had the little wireless receiver and transmitter, and while the brain was receiving signals that were punched in at a board, they went to a computer, which already at the time, in the late 60s and early 70s, was automated. It didn't need a person to make the decisions. And it received and read brain waves and was able to modify those brain waves and send reciprocal signals back to the human subject's brain, or the chimp's brain in this case, and supposedly modify their brain activity. It was changing the spindle levels.
Spindles.
It got into a very technical area, but the point is, they were modifying brain activity based on, you know, a subject like Leonard Kyle. He might have some kind of spike, and they say, "Oh, that proves you're a bad person and you're violent.
You're getting upset now. So we got to turn that off."
So that computer is able to shut that down until that part of the brain just isn't active anymore. It goes from maybe 95% active to less than 1% active, they said.
That's the main effect of all intrusions into the brain, whether it's psychiatric drugs or illegal drugs or alcohol or a blow on the head or psychosurgery or brain stimulation. The brain, in effect, wears out. The brain stops responding and the person becomes duller. And that's going to be, folks, the final common pathway. Every time you hear that a new psychiatric drug is working or a new brain stimulation is working, just means it's another variant on dulling the brain. That's the sad truth. The stimulation, you know, it might change your views of God just by making you duller and less interested.
Right.
Let me address something about the electronics that I'm learning more and more about. And we've got about maybe 7 or 8 minutes left.
Oh, we talked all.
We're doing great. Oh, okay. You guys are you guys are beautiful. I wish you were here to hear the applause coming from the audience for you, because you're beautiful. I think, folks, this is maybe the most important show I've ever done. I don't know that I've ever said that before. I was hoping it would be, because I know Aaron and Melissa Dykes. I know what they're doing. I know who they are. So there's something in common between what Elon Musk is doing with putting these hair thin or even thinner electrodes into the brain to stimulate the brain, and what's being done when you put the electrodes on the heads of the children, because and stimulate the brain, because the power being used in these low voltage methods is not going to do what the psychosurgery did, which is melt holes in the brain. What it's doing is it's activating nerves. So in the case of Elon Musk, he puts in this little electrode. There are going to be God knows how many of them, and they're going to be throughout different areas of the brain. It's all going to be guessing. And they'll put a current through. And what it's going to do to the adjacent neurons is it's going to cause them to fire. It's such a low voltage, it's not going to travel up the neurons. It's going to make them fire. So what's going to happen then with the electrodes on the head? Well, the same thing's going to happen. It's going to stimulate nerves in the skin, the trigeminal nerve, probably the facial nerve. I mean, all this I'm working on now, literally, as a scientist with the neuroscientists who have come out from under to say, we don't want this happening to children. They want to work with me on this. And we're talking together. How does this work when you use the low voltages? Well, all it can do is create a point at which a nerve is fired. And then the nerve takes over. Now, one of the interesting parts to show you how bizarre this is going to be and how harmful is, even if the nerve is one that is a sensory nerve that is either in the brain or in your skin picking up impulses that are coming from the outside, it's going to put up an impulse in them in reverse. They'll depolarize the nerves in reverse. So let's say you've got a nerve that's coming down your trigeminal nerve, and it's really picking up, it's actually doing motor activities, it's making your jaw work, maybe. Trigeminal nerve will make your jaw work. It's going to activate that nerve backwards, so the child's going to get an impulse, a nerve impulse, like has never been in the system before, going back up the nerve into the brain and into areas as high up as the highest centers in the frontal lobes. That's been demonstrated. It's changing brain waves coming out of the frontal lobes when you do this to the children. And that's what's going to happen with these low voltage stimulations in the brain. It's going to be affecting hundreds of surrounding neurons, making them fire in a completely senseless fashion. And it's not going to be some subtle message like you have pleasure or you have pain. Or it's going to be something the brain cannot integrate. It's going to be impulses going like hammer blows, is the way one of the neuroscientists explained it to me. It's not like a message. It's a hammer blow coming out of the impulse, which is the hammer, which is then going to be rhythmically or non-rhythmically, however the impulse are being electrically transmitted, it's going to go and flood areas of the brain through nerves that have never even received incoming impulses before. And it's going to be going to up nerves that are specialized to receive impulses from the outside. So that's what we're going to be doing to our children, leaving these devices on all night long for God knows how many months or years, studied for 4 weeks. That's the monarch.
This is very
horrifying.
Yeah.
It's absolutely. And the thing is with these devices, yeah, like you say, they're just allowing, they're making special rules to just allow these things to come through with they have no idea what the long-term effects of any of this is going to be. One of the things that they mentioned in the Q&A of the Neuralink presentation was that the FDA had just magically released new draft guidelines that would prescribe for them exactly what they would need to do to get their device approved in February. So they came out with their presentation in July. So just in the few months prior to that, the FDA suddenly releasing a set of prescriptive draft guidelines seemingly specially for this thing to be approved. I mean, it's all about just getting it out there seemingly as quickly as possible.
That's what's troubling, because they didn't invent Neuralink or some similar device because they want to treat epilepsy or they want to cure Parkinson's. Those are potential applications. They really just want a lot of people to have a mediating device in their brain. And if that one fails, well, maybe that company will fail, but the overall idea will continue. That's what we've seen in this research. You know, they have hundreds of buckets, little companies and little vehicles to move this forward. And in some ways, we've seen in Silicon Valley, and I say this as by metaphor, not implicating them directly, Silicon Valley is into fast fail, meaning if they put a company out there and something goes terribly wrong, they want it to crash and burn, so they'll stop putting more money into it, and they'll move that money into a slightly different application. Yeah. And I think they could do something very similar in neuroscience. And again, though, I see these all as integrating. I see advances on the internet integrating with the advances in neuroscience.
And with Monarch, with this stimulating,
stimulating device.
The brazen,
and by the way, it's not going to stimulate the kids. It's going to make them apathetic in the long run.
I don't even think the real reason is ADHD or any other condition.
It isn't.
I think that's an excuse. I think
One of the things we've got, let me see here. I'm looking at my phone. I need a bigger clock. I'm just learning my technology here. I've got about 2 minutes left, I'd say.
Sorry.
And one of the points I want to make is that Elon Musk, in your wonderful film, which is put a chip in your brain, and it's on your website, you know, which is TruthStream Media. And I want to say again, this is Aaron and Melissa Dykes. Elon Musk said that what they're doing is working with the FDA to get this device, this bizarre device we've been talking about, in use for neurologically damaged people, because that's the way to get it in. And then it'll be approved as a
device.
For
everyone.
That's what I'm
saying.
And then after that, folks, they can buy any neurosurgeon, any neurologist, any psychiatrist, any GP they want to use those devices. The only thing that will stop them is somebody fighting it, because the FDA does not control what happens to things they approve of once they're approved. And their approval after 4 weeks, one study, that's a meaningless thing. They're already getting headaches and you know, muscle spasms in the face and all. But it's a lousy 4 weeks.
It's terrible.
Once that they've approved that, now we're going to be in the situation where any doc can say, "Mom, we've got this new device that was invented for ADHD. I think your son has a variation on ADHD. I've been reading it helps depression in children, and it's unleashed." Wow. I wanted to get that into it. And we're drawing to a close now. I think this is one of the most important interviews I've ever had. This is cutting edge, folks. If you really want to know where the threats are, it's here today. And the music is starting. We're coming to an end on an amazing interview. I'm glad that you two felt free to just talk as you have about what you see going on.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, you're doing great work in the world. Folks, send this around. Get this show viral. Let the world know what in the world's going on in our future in the name of medicine and science. And thank you, my wonderful, wonderful audience. Thank you, PRN. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you, PRN.